that's in vogue. Don't let go. Coming up right after this song, The Soul Savage Show. Every Thursday here on Studio W The Buzz. Just a bad boy having a party. Let's get it.
Gonna have us a good time tonight. Every time that we meet, we skip and we dip to the beat. Yeah. What in the world could be better than getting together? Yeah. The last time we partied, it ended when the sun came. That's why your mama told you that you couldn't go out. Stay in the house. Won't sneak out tonight. He's gonna take by her tonight. Cause he sure wants to go out, man. Everyone's here, let them all in. No one wanted to miss. If you don't get home on the double, you're going to be in trouble. I hope your mama don't look in your room, cause if she has, she'll be here soon. She's gonna be mad. You're a bad boy. You got it bad. Say goodbye to your friend. Gonna be a while till you swim again. Bad boy, don't sneak out tonight. He's gonna tip by her window, cause he sure wants to get out and dance. Gonna sneak out tonight. corner by her window.
All right, and we are here. Man, oh man, oh man, it's the time for that show, the Soul Savage Show with Whitney and Q Lynn. Hey, good evening, good afternoon, good night, ladies. What's going on?
What's up, Will?
Going all right, Will. How are you doing?
Doing good, doing good. Just hanging out. Glad to be back. Missed you guys over the last couple of weeks. Boy, we had... Yeah. Well, I've been listening in.
Gone for a while.
Man, oh man, oh man.
Yes.
Yep. And thank Mr. Melody for filling in week before last. And last week, unfortunately, we had to postpone the show.
Yes.
But anyway, we're back on right now. I'm excited and ready to go. What's your lineup tonight,
Q-Lin? Yes, we got so much going on. First off, we got to introduce our special guest that's on right now. I just say I'm a new fan. I feel like I'm a fan now because this man's writing is so impeccable. I just started reading his biopic. It's called Luther, The Life and Longing of Luther Vandross, a book. He's a author, music critic. He's written for the Washington Post, Entertainment Weekly. But his credentials are so long. Like, I always sit here and just keep name dropping and stuff like that. But just to say a little bit. You know, he's interviewed like people like Janet Jackson, Mariah Carey, Beyonce. You know, just I ain't gonna keep putting it out there. I'm just gonna say this man is his writing is fine. He also has a podcast called Craig's Pop Life. I'm just gonna introduce him right now. Y'all give it up for Mr. Craig Seymour. He's on the line right now. Y'all give it up. Yes, we got that in the budget. We got the class in the budget. We can afford claps now, so we got
you
claps.
Afford this clap. Okay, I like some claps. Thank you very much.
How are you doing tonight, sir? How are you doing?
So I know I am doing so well, and I'm so happy to be here with y'all. I can't tell you. That was such a beautiful intro, and it's just always a great occasion to be able to talk about the great Luther Vandross. So I'm here for this conversation. I said, what are we going to do?
Yes, I played that song just to use Luther Vandross, Bad Boy, Swingin', Having a Party. It's one of my top favorite Luther songs. I was like, we gotta start the show off right. We got a summer song, it's a great summer song. I'm like, we gotta start the show off right. So, we played that just for you on the show, Luther Vandross. And so, I don't know where to start, man. I'm trying to, you know what I mean? It's so many questions I have for you, and I ask a lot of questions, so I'm gonna just start off and just get to the genesis. I like to call it the genesis of how your introduction to music, when did it first start in your childhood? If you could give me that just a little bit. Of when your childhood, like when you were first introduced to music, like your intrigue of music, like if you have a memory that stands out.
Did we lose our guest?
I'm not sure.
I thought it was me.
It's all right. It's live radio, y'all. We do. This is what we do. Okay.
Yeah, it could happen.
Just see if he's on the line. I think he dropped. Yes, he's dropped. I think somehow he dropped on the line. I'm not sure. But we're going to keep going until he come back. You know, we're gonna see. You know, a little technical difficulty. I don't know what's going on, but yeah, wait for him to get on the line. But I guess we could do a quick little Savvy update before he gets on. Savvy update is we got some new stuff planned for the show. And I'm going to start implementing Facebook and Instagram. And we're going to start shooting this show live as soon as I can get technically savvy and learn how to operate things. It's going to happen. You know, so we gonna keep that in the midst of an ongoing update because it's taking so long because it takes me that long to figure it out. It's a struggle, you know, trying to figure out Facebook, Instagram, implementing cameras and stuff like that. You know, that's why you gotta pay people to do that because if you depend on me to do it, we gonna be shooting from my laptop that looks like a flip phone. But yes, Mr. Craig Seymour, I didn't know what happened.
I'm back. I don't know, the devil's working overtime today, and I don't know what's going on.
Listen, we are going to bind him, and we're going to put it in the atmosphere that he's not welcomed on the show. So we're going to continue on like that didn't happen. We're going to edit that in audio when we put it out there. It's all right. But I was asking your childhood, what's your genesis with music in terms of, like, when you realized, like, when you started getting engulfed into the music, when you were interested in it? When did that happen for you in your childhood?
Okay. Well, I'm a civil rights baby, okay? So I was born in 1968, and everybody knows what went down in 1968. You know what
I mean? Right.
I was born right in the thick of things, and, you know, so I came up in the soul era, you know, just with music being just such a part of black life, whether what's playing on the radio, what's playing at your grandma's house, what's playing at home, what your mama's listening to when she's all alone at night, what, you know what I mean? And then the great black record stores where it's like the people behind the counters, it wasn't like Best Buy where you just ask them for something and they, you know, they were trying to educate you about the music and say, oh, will you buy this? You're going to need to buy this too because this is going to teach you about somebody else. Oh, and you need to know about Nina Simone. And, oh, you need to know about. So I grew up in a black community that was, I grew up in D.C., Chocolate City. So, like, I grew up in a community that was really very much focused on music and very much as I learned, you know, my black civil rights facts and have my black civil rights flashcards and my relatives would test, oh, what did that? Who invented the peanut? Who, you know what I mean? As much as I was doing that, it would also be about, okay, I'm going to play this song. Who's this song by? Okay, who's this vocalist? Who's singing this? So I came up through a community that, where music was just so vitally important to black life. And I think all of my understanding and appreciation and the way I feel about music to this current day really goes back to being a child of the civil rights and the soul era.
Because I'm interested in, because the time period when you say 68, so I would say, was it like the mid 70s when, like during that time period, was there anything in particular? Was you just taking in all different genres, just soul music in general? Because I know disco music kind of came in kind of the cusp of 78, 79 a little bit.
That was a little bit later. And that was the kind of thing. So like my earliest experiences, and I was one of those kids, like I was got my first record player and I was told that I was just, you know, playing records out. I was told that I used to be obsessed with Sly and the Family Stone greatest hits. I don't even listen to Sly and Family Stone anymore. But not that I have anything against that. I'm just saying, like, I don't have a memory of that, although everybody in my family has a memory of being really obsessed with Sly and the Family Stone. And so, you know, just records, and it was so intergenerational. It's like the young people, we would like our little records, but it's not like the older folks would hate on our records, and it's not like we wouldn't like the older records either. And I came from a generation, you know, so like my grandparents, they like jazz, so they would be teaching me about Duke Ellington and Charlie Parker and Dinah Washington, and my mother was very politically oriented, so even though she liked her ballads, she was teaching me about Gil Scott-Heron and The Last Poets and people like that. So it was very much about an education and just understanding how, as black people, we work through our stuff in the music, you know? And so for me, like, it's interesting because of my age, so, and it's going to shake a lot of people, so just hold on to their, I hope nobody draws a throat and but like, just because of my age, I was really more into the Silvers. If y'all remember the Silvers, I was really into the Silvers almost more than I was into the Jackson 5. Foster Silvers was my man. Misdemeanor was my cut. I used to say it because the Silvers, you know, Silvers had a big family, and I was the only child at the time. So I would be looking at the back of the Silvers covers like, ooh, I wish she was my sister, and I bet we would be the closest, but then we'd probably be talking about her because she looks like she probably has something to say. You know, I would be making up all, just like people do fan fiction now, I'd be making up all sorts of fan fiction about the Silvers family. You know? So that was my big thing. And then when Janet started coming out doing her, Janet Jackson was doing the Las Vegas shows and then doing Good Times and everything. Janet was the Jackson that I really connected with because she was just 2 years older than I am. So that was kind of my connection. So yeah, it was just everything. It's just growing up in a really wonderful time. And you mentioned disco, and you know, disco for black people was just stuff we was listening to that all of a sudden white people decided to listen to one day and called it disco. Because for us, we were listening to like the Philly International sound. We were listening to the Herb Melvin and the Blue Notes and the Three Degrees and all of these really lush records with the strings and all of that kind of stuff. That became the foundation of disco. But wasn't anybody calling it disco then. Those were just the hype cuts, you know. Those are just the hype up-tempo cuts. So it's really interesting having lived through that whole history.
Wow. And so I want to ask in terms of, so was it, because I love reading biopics and watching different documentaries. And so just as a music journalist, I just took all that information in, just used information. Is it like the same for you in terms of, was it an intentional thing or was it just something that just naturally happened in terms of the being a music historian?
Well, I think as a kid, you know, I took in as much as I possibly could. So it's like, you know, I was that kid always reading the liner notes, always trying to figure out, oh, this person wrote this song, and they wrote that song, or what? And then, so then the next time I went to the record store and I saw somebody wrote that song, I thought, no, I need to get this album because I like those person's songs. So I would kind of make the connections that way. But then at the same time, just in terms of black life, you know, you couldn't go to nobody's house and there wasn't going to be an Ebony and there wasn't going to be a Jet sitting right there. Do you know what I mean? So just in the course of that, I would read my Ebony's cover from cover. I would read my Jet's cover to cover and get information about my stars like that way. You know, ooh, Stephanie Mills dating Michael Jackson, what? And, you know, I'd be getting a lot of information about that. And then as I got older, I got my subscription to the good Right On magazine, although I prefer Black Beat for some reason. I don't know why. But, you know, and I would read my Black Beat from cover to cover, my Right On magazine from cover to cover, and just any information that I could get. Of course, I'd watch Soul Train every week. Just any information I could get. In fact, my mother used to make fun of me because she's a lawyer. But, like, I would keep almost like an FBI dossier on my favorite singers. So, like, my favorite singers, like Chaka Khan. So, whenever, if there was a Chaka Khan picture, article, whatever, I would take a little neat. You know, take my little kitty scissors, you know, the little kitty scissors you can't cut yourself. I would take my little kitty scissors and take out that page, grab one of her file folders, put it in a file folder, label it Chaka Khan, and I have files on people. So I was a researcher even then because I wanted to know and I wanted to be able to reference and go back to stuff. So I was just really just obsessed with the music and the lives of the people who made the music.
Wow. And so you've done, so going into high school, when did that era change for you to where you wanted to pursue it professionally, being a music journalist?
I think a lot of times, I think, you know, when we're kids and stuff like that, I think the first dream is always we want to be a performer, right? So, even though I couldn't really sing or couldn't really whatever, I mean, I probably could auto-tune. If it was a different era, maybe I could have been an auto-tune person. I don't know. But back in the day, when you really need to stand flat-footed and, you know, make some notes come out of your mouth that made some sense, I wasn't that one. But I would sit there and I would look and say, okay, who's the president of this record company? And I would write the president of the record company, put me a little picture in the book, you know, put it in the envelope and send it off. You know, I used to collect my rejection letters. I had rejection letters. You know, oh, we really appreciate you sending this in. You know, stay high to your, stay, you know, keep to your dreams, young black man. You know, maybe one day you're going to make it. You know? Just stuff like that.
Right.
So I think that when we talk about high school, now we're getting into the 80s and we're getting into, like, the Princes, and we're getting into this kind of thing where blackness was kind of being expanded and explored and stretched in kind of different ways. Do you know what I mean? And then at the same time, we had that big crossover thing where everybody was trying not to be as soulful, but they were really trying to hit those white charts, you know? And so that was a very strange time. I think we got a lot of interesting music out of it, but that was a time when I think it was really kind of hard to find. There was definitely a disconnect between the very socially conscious music that I had been listening to, that I had been raised on as a child, and the kind of music that was being made in the early 80s. But of course, you know, I'm a teenager, so Prince, he's, you know, sing about sex and stuff like that. So of course I'm right there. You know what I mean? I'm there for that. And then because we're teenagers, what you supposed to do? So then, around the same time, I started, you know, I had like a group of white friends, and they were very much into like British New Wave and synth pop and all the synthesizers. And then around that time, a lot of R&B artists started bringing in synthesizers, like on Luther Vandross's Busybody, and a lot of mm-hmm. stuff that Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis were doing with the SOS band. So that became kind of a bridge for me. It's kind of like I could understand that, you know, the white kids didn't get it, and like a lot of my black friends didn't get it, but I understood that there was a connection and a kind of communication being formed between these groups that were making these kind of funky, heavily synthesized stuff overseas, and people right at home using the same instruments to create funky sounds here. So that was kind of a period where I really saw kind of a connection.
I wanted to ask, in terms of just how you look at music, do you ever, is it a point to where when you're writing, it's like, would you just, I know you said you looked at the liner notes and you looked at the credits and who was on there. What parts of did you ever like break down music to like you, where you're describing, I'm talking about the synthesizers and stuff like that. Did writing start making sense to you? Did you, when was that point to where you understood your voice as a writer?
That's a really good point, because I don't know anything about music. I couldn't tell you a note. I couldn't tell you sometimes if it's the guitar or the bass playing, or it might even be a drum. Like, I can't tell you about no notes. But I always connected to music lyrically, because my mom, like I said, she's a lawyer, and she always, being a lawyer, she's very much about the word. You know, when you read a case, you read every little word and every little meaning, and she would always stop me and ask, what is the song saying? Why do you like the song? What is the meaning behind the song? Why did the person write the song in that way? Why did they choose these words? I mean, we could just be driving down the street listening to the, you know, and all of a sudden I'd be in the middle of an English quiz. But it's like, she always wanted me to know that whenever somebody wrote a song, they did that for a purpose, and every single word they chose or the way they sang something or whatever was intentional. So she wanted me to think about that and not just take that for granted. And I think that is the fundamental of me later becoming a critic, because I understood that there was intention and real artistry and thought behind everything, from a party song to a really emotional ballad. You know, there was thought behind it, and she always made me, and if something what didn't make any sense, she'd be like, this song doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? And she would, and sometimes a song doesn't make sense for a great way, but sometimes the song just doesn't make sense, and it just doesn't make sense, and it's bad. So all of that, I think, was training ground for me becoming a writer. And so I didn't really become a writer until very late. What happened was I went to, but music was always just, you know, my first love, always obsessed with music. I went to college, kind of, like, because I was so into music, and I was really into club music. So in high school, I dropped out of high school because it was getting in the way of my club going, you know what I mean? Because sometimes you'd be out and you don't really feel like getting to school in the morning. So after a while, I just said, you know, that school doesn't really work for me. I really,
right.
Yeah, really cutting in on my club life and, you know, priorities. So I dropped out of school, but I ended up getting a GED. And luckily, this is one of the reasons why I'm so into social programs can really save people's lives. There was just some kind of weird social program where if you had scored, this was in Maryland, and if you had scored a certain amount on your GED, then you were allowed to get provisionally into the University of Maryland. So without having to write an application or do anything and doing the whole extracurricular, you just got in on like a provisional program, and if you did all right on the provisional program, you were in. So that's really the only reason why I got into college, because I was not focused. I was not anything. It's just one of those, it's just God's grace, you know. So I got into school, messed up a couple more times, flunked out twice, but then they also had a program where if you give a good enough excuse about why you were now mature enough to sit your butt in class, you know, and actually read these books and get them grades, then they would let you in again provisionally. So I got into one of those programs. And then finally, I was able to get my mind right. And that's when I went ahead and graduated with my undergraduate degree. I ended up getting a master's. And then after the master's, I ended up going into a PhD program. And after, so that was all good. And it was all, you know, and I was kind of, it's almost like a switch. Like once I decided to switch to be serious about school, then I was like really serious about school, you know. I mean, I still went clubbing and everything like that, but I was serious about school. But then one day I was just kind of like, you know, I'm writing about all this stuff because I'd be writing papers about, if, you know, Queen Latifah and black feminism and all this. I would be writing all these papers on topics of the music that I was listening to. But the people that were reading the papers and all the people in my classes didn't have any idea what in the world I was talking about. And so after a while, I just kind of got to be like, you know what? Like, I really want to write for my people. Like, I really want to write stuff that is in dialogue with what the people who are like me, who are listening to this music, who are loving this music, mm-hmm. that they are, I want to be in communication with them. And so that's when I started to write local publications in the Washington Post and things like that, and ask them if I could write reviews. Now, this just so happened to be at a time when hip-hop and, you know, hip-hop and R&B and everything was becoming such a big part of the popular culture landscape. But most of the pop critics and the writers at these mainstream publications, they ain't know nothing about that. I mean, they were still talking about John Lennon and the Beatles. And stuff. I mean, that's where their heads were at. They weren't trying to write about DMX. You know what I mean? So they needed writers like me to do that. So I was very much had a window of opportunity where I was let into the industry because I could write about things that needed to be written about because the audience was demanding it, but the people that were on staff at the paper had no idea what it was.
Wow. And you're segueing perfectly because the next question I had was about the interviews you've done in terms of what was, because I know for me, I'm kind of selfish. I'm not going to say kind of. I'm always selfish because I mostly do it just for me, just that music nerd in me that was that reads the liner notes and is like, okay, this producer did this, this songwriter did this, this drummer did this, this musician, and then I get in depth. I want to ask that artist that question and get into it because I hate asking gossip questions about their personal life and stuff that's not related to the music. So I always try to get to that. I listen to your interview, you posted, it was on YouTube, the My Life, when Mary J. Blige did her My Life album and talked about it. I thought it was like one of the greatest interviews I ever listened to because she was really getting in depth with the music and I was just amazed by it. And I just want to know what was it you've interviewed, I listed off in the beginning in your intro of all the artists that you've interviewed. What's the goal, I guess I should say, in terms of your interviews? I know you said that you're conveying, trying to get to the culture and get to that, but is it anything beyond, is it that intrigue of the music, just being fans of the music, that you want to ask those questions? Or is it that you lean more towards the audience? Or is it more personally for you when doing these interviews?
I mean, my goal, first and foremost, is I'm a human being. I'm a child of God. You a human being. You a child of God. We just talking.
Right.
How are you today?
Let's start
with that. Let's get into that, and then let's get to what we need to talk about. But, like, people think I ask a lot of personal questions, and I do, but I ask them, like, from a true earnest place of, like...
Is you good, sis?
Like, what? Like, let's talk. Let's talk about it, and let's talk about how this manifests itself in the music, because these are real people with real emotions. And when you get somebody like Mary J. Blige, she's not turning emotion on and off. Like, what she feels deeply is what's going on in the music. So I ask stuff about that, and I think that's why people open up to me, because they know that I'm not really in it for the gossip factor. I'm actually interested in their lives as people, you know, and just try. I mean, I think my whole thing is, we're all out here, does nobody have a handbook on life? We're all trying to understand what this is. We're all engaged in the struggle. And so I'm just, from one person struggling to another person struggling, let's just talk. Let's just, okay, how did you make this album? Well, what was going on when you were making this album? Oh, that reminds me. And then, you know, stuff reminds me of stuff. And I go, that reminds me of somebody that did that to me. Oh, that person did you wrong like that? Another, you know, it's just a conversation. But it's not calculated. I mean, I always have, like, and part of this is also because I'm, like, an extreme researcher. So before I go into the conversation with somebody, I've researched every single thing that they've ever said about that topic. Because what I don't want to do is waste my limited amount of time asking them some mess that they've done already addressed somewhere else. Do you know
what
I
mean? Right, exactly. I know exactly what you mean.
Down. So then we can just have a conversation, and maybe a genuine moment can come forth from that conversation, because they don't feel like they just are going through question one, question two, question three, question four, that they're always asked about the same thing. You know, and that, I think, is probably the key to, and I always look at it as like a conversation. The only thing I do is that there are certain kind of things that my editors sometimes want me to definitely ask, and I can get so caught up in the conversation so that I always have like a little steno pad or something that might have like two or three questions on it, to where as if they say, okay, we need to wrap up now, three more questions, I can just ask those three questions just because I know I have to ask them.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't get fired. You know what I mean? But that's right. Pretty much the only thing that I do that's really just because I'm really much more interested in the way the conversation goes. And the thing about the Mary thing that just, like, I just love so much is, she was really having a bad day that day with her current boyfriend. You know what I mean? And here I'm asking her about her past boyfriend, and like, but she wasn't scared to share that with me, and it was cool. It was obviously something that she just needed to get off her chest, and I was glad that I was there to give her the opportunity to get off her chest, and it was what it was, you know. And you have to let people do that. I would have been a jerk to be like, oh, well, you know, I know enough about your new man. I mean, I know he may have just done you wrong with this, but I'm really trying to get back to the old man, because that's what I really need to do about this assignment. I mean, I'd have been a jerk. That's just not even conceivable that I would have done something like that, even if it had turned out that I wasn't able to get anything from the interview. I just think that it's important how you do people. And a really lesson of that came to me via Twitter not that long ago, because I used to be the pop music critic in Atlanta. And I used to spend a lot of time around Monica. Monica is one of my favorite people. If you talk about a real, a person who keeps it 100 all day long, doesn't act phony, doesn't act fake, doesn't put on any airs, that is Monica all day, every day. And Monica's aunt used to work with me at the paper. so, you know, Monica's aunt would come by and she'd be showing me pictures of their weekend barbecue and stuff. And then Monica and I would go out to like a steakhouse and stuff and talk. You know, part of it would be for using in an interview, but it wouldn't be like, okay, this is the interview for this thing.
But
you know, I always felt like, I mean, I'd always try to do right by people, try to do right by Monica. So just this random thing, you know, Monica's a country, she's from Georgia. You know, she's a country girl. Every time I was with her in a car, there was a gun somewhere. You know what I mean? Because she carries, I mean, people in the South carry guns.
They call it a Glockana on the internet. I think
sometimes people that maybe aren't from the South or something don't realize that, like, people in the South have guns. Like, that's not a big deal. But I had mentioned something like that on Twitter. And, man, people lost their minds. I was trying to say, oh, Monica's such a thug. Monica's this and that. And I'm just like, all I literally said is that she was a licensed gun carrier. I don't know how this got so out of hand.
So
she wrote to me, and she's like, why are you dry snitching on me on the internet? I'm like, I did not think there was any issue at all about, and I was even defending her and saying that, you know, people think Monica is not a thug. Monica's just about her business, and you just don't, as long as you don't cross her or cross any of hers, she's cool. But the minute you step to her, step to somebody she cares for, then yeah, it might be on. But,
you know how the internet is, they'll take it and flip it into something else that's not what it is. Yeah.
But she even meant, she said, you know, you were always one of the people that I was always the most comfortable with, and I talked to you more than I talked to anybody and all that kind of stuff. And we just had this cool moment over Twitter, and I was just glad, because I haven't talked to Monica in 15, 20 years, but it's just good to know that the way that as many interviewers as she must have been interviewed by between then and now, and even before, that whatever energy I put out was received to her as good energy, and she still felt that I was a good person. I wasn't trying to do her wrong in any kind of way. And I just appreciated that, because that's always the way that I go into a situation.
Right. And that's what it is. I think you're right. I'm just stuck on, I read the Luther Vandross Bible that you had, the Life and Long in the Luther Vandross. I was so, when I tell you, it's only certain authors that, like, floor me when I'm reading. The one that created the Rick James biopic, it's just certain writers that speak to me. And when I tell you, when I read that biopic, I look at it like, because I always make musical references as, you know, like when you hear a certain album, you know, like you can go track for track and you don't skip it. And then it's like certain songs, it's like every song, like, you gotta keep repeating it because it's so good, you gotta keep going back. I'm like, no, I gotta hear this again. And then sometimes you just like, gotta pause it for a minute because it's so good and you gotta take it, it takes a minute for you to take it all in. That's what me reading that book was, because it's like, your visual, I felt like I was reading like a screenplay for a movie. Like, that's what I felt like, because it was so, visually, like I was so intrigued with it. Like, I didn't stop reading it. Like, I couldn't stop reading. I'm like, oh, I gotta go do this. No, I can't do it. But when I read the book, I'm telling you right now, because I don't do this often, but that book had me really, like, engulfed. Like, and I was just, I felt like I knew Luther just from reading that. Like, I grew up with him and stuff like that. And so I want to know, how did you get to that point in your writing to where you could, like, convey this kind of message with your kind of writing to where you can paint a picture visually, like, so, like, clear as day to where you can convey that to an audience that's reading your book? How did that happen for you?
Well, I think there are two things. One of it is, like I said, I just research, but almost none of the research makes it into the book. But it's like sometimes you will read something that it might not even really be on Luther or something, but you'll read that, like, oh, but he was wearing a you know, flaming red scarf or something like that. And I'm like, wow. And, it, you know, sometimes those little details stick out to me. And so I really research so much just for those one or two details that I think will really bring something alive. And it could be like one, it might be an adjective in the book. It might not come up to anything. And I might have spent 5 hours reading stuff in order to get that. But it's just kind of, they're just certain things, a certain dialogue people say or something like that, that I think are so evocative of the person that those are the things I look for. It's almost like digging for gems. You know what I mean? Like you read it, and then you're like, aha, that is the moment. And going into Luther, the way I wanted to write Luther is that I wanted to write that story from the point of view of when you open that book, you don't necessarily, I mean, everybody knows what Luther amounted to, right? But I wanted the reader to go through the experience of a person that did not know what they would ultimately become in the world. Luther started out with a dream. That is all that man had. That man had a dream and 365 zillion obstacles in his way of becoming what he wanted to do. So I wanted you to go through his journey and really feel like the drive that he had, but just feel each heartbreak, each obstacle, I know sometimes when I would reread the book, I would be like, well, damn, is he ever going to, you know, even knowing the story, is he ever going to get the solo deal? Is he ever going to get a hit? Because it went on for so long, and I'd be thinking to myself, I would have been giving up and taking a job at JCPenney's or whatever, you know,
right.
It was a lot. And, you know, so I wanted that story to come through because it's so easy to look back. When somebody's successful, it's so easy to look back and go, oh, it was inevitable. Oh, of course Luther has this great voice. Of course he would have become a superstar. No, nothing in life is inevitable. These things happen because people will them to happen against all odds, and they're also have a whole lot of grace along the way, and that's how those things happen. And so I really wanted you to get the sense of Luther at every stage of his career and understand the devastating disappointment. And yet what did he do? He found some kind of way to get back up, try it again until it started working. And the other thing I wanted to get from the book, because people talk about that I tell a lot of the stories of the people that influence him, kind of like almost little mini biographies of a couple paragraphs of the people that influenced him. And I also wanted you to get that. I didn't want to just say, oh, he was influenced by Aretha Franklin and go on by that. I wanted you to understand who Aretha Franklin was at the time that Luther was influenced by her, so that you can really get a sense of exactly what he was connecting to. Not just some general idea that the reader might have had about Aretha Franklin, but I wanted you to know that he was listening to this album. This song was speaking to him at this time while this was going on in his life. That's the kind of depth of connection that I wanted you to get through the book.
And you know what? I'm going to try to tie this in with this, because what you're saying kind of leads to my next question. I think you kind of answered it for me, but I'm going to throw it back to you in terms of, but before that, with what I realized early, this is early in the first few pages that I read, when you talk about that rejection that he had, excuse me, it was the discipline, what I realized reading it, the love, the art of the being a student of the craft, the discipline in that was what kept him going, because he said, just to quote, I don't want to mess up the quote, but just to paraphrase, he said that he was rejected from the Apollo when he was, you know what I mean, leading up to that, being rejected. Yes, being rejected, that made him tougher, and then also, just the rejection alone, he realized that it's just a matter of opportunity, meeting the right person that's going to put you in that space to do whatever it is that you want to do musically. And I think just building up that discipline that he had in the music, just because that's what he did, you know, was just into the music, that's where the discipline came from to build that up. So I wanted to throw it back to you and ask you, what discipline did you have to keep writing?
You don't even want to know. Well,
oh no, I want to know.
It was not. I'm saying. The Luther thing, you know, it was such the assignment to get there, it was such a love affair. What happened was, I'd always wanted to write a book. And so I had all these different book ideas, and especially around the people that I interviewed extensively, right? So Luther had his stroke, and then one day my agent was like, do you think, you know, would you be interested in writing a book about Luther? And I'd be like, of course I'd be interested in writing a book about Luther. Had he had the stroke, you know. And so the book sold very quickly, but then it was on, because they wanted it right out, I was on a 6-month deadline. Now, I had never written anything more than like a magazine article or anything like that. I didn't never know how to put together a book. I didn't know how to structure a book. I didn't know any of it. So then it's like the next, so I, you know, so I get the deal and I'm excited. Hey, you know, went out for some drinks, clink, 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 clink. And then the next day it was like, now what now? So it was really a process of me figuring out all of that just by like, I mean, it's grace. I believe in grace so much, and just how that book came together. First of all, I have no memory of that entire 6-month period. And also during that time, my stepfather died, and I had to take care of my mother and my little brother during that time as I was writing all of this stuff. So it was just, but it, that was an interesting thing too, though, in a way, just because even watching my little brother, it was just, it was so profound understanding the loss of Luther's father, and later, my little brother, once he was old enough to read, he felt that in the writing, like he felt like that really moved him the way I wrote about the pain of Luther losing his father, because he really could relate to that. And that was a sort of something I was kind of watching through his eyes while I was actually writing that book. So just all sorts of just really weird things were going on. But like I said, that was really an act of just, it's one of those things where, you know, people try to say, oh, I need to be in the mood to write. I need to light me some candles. I need to go to bed, pass me on, and give me a nice pillow. And that was incredible. Me just, like, writing, not wanting to write, writing. I didn't watch TV for 6 months, you know, and just, I think it was because I had done so much research on Luther and because I had lived Luther, and I had a very clear idea of being about him becoming the person that he became and his fight to become the person that he wanted to be. I was so clear about that, that I think that's what ultimately made the book work despite all of the obstacles. Despite, I mean, there were times, I'm keeping 100 with you. There were times when I was like, because when you get a book deal, you get an advance. There'd be times I'd be sitting up like going, I wonder how long it would take if I just didn't do the book. I wonder how long it would take me to pay back this advance. Like, could I get a part-time job? Could I be? I wonder if they would take an installment plan. I wonder if I could go down to the loan shop. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wonder how I could. And I'd be thinking, well, how embarrassed would people be? Like, I literally would be fantasizing about how I could pay this money back, because, like, I just wasn't. There was so many times when I really wasn't sure that it was going to be able to come off, but that's why it just means so much to me that even years after the book was out, it means so much to me that years after the book is out, people still see what my intention it was for the book. And that's why I believe so strongly in artistic intention. I think if you start anything with a clear idea of what you want to do, I think that no matter what comes your way, that intention, I think, in my experience, still shines through after years, after whatever. And so that's why I'm just always so clear about what my intention is for what I'm trying to do, because there's so many things that you can't control in the artistic process, But the one thing that you can always do is be clear about your intention. And that's definitely a lesson that that book taught me.
Man, you just moved my spirit with that. It's man, you just overwhelmed me. But go ahead, Whitney. Go ahead real quick. I can gather myself.
Like, I don't know what type of question I can ask now. Like, wow.
No, you just,
like,
that's the way with that.
Yeah.
It's like something internally just happened to my spirit when he said that. That's so moving. Go ahead, though.
Wow. So I want to ask a little. Yeah. Well, no, it's just
all emotional and stuff.
That was like the perfect like ending.
Crazy.
Like what? Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say after no more after that. You just got me all.
Girl, you gonna be okay?
I don't know. I'm trying to drink this ginger ale through it. Go ahead.
There you go. So I want to ask a little bit more about your kind of academic experience. So when Q-Lynn told me about you, I was like, oh, let me go read up on this guy because I don't know if I'm really completely familiar with who this is. And so I started looking at just kind of your biography on your webpage. And as I was reading through, like, the high school dropout thing, and then I saw PhD, and then I started reading on your R&B site. The Aretha article is the one that I'm going to ask you about that one here in a minute, but I was just kind of reading through everything, and I was like, wow, the way he put stuff together is really like I feel like I kind of walk through, like, that space of time, like, as you're writing it, and I feel like that's a really, I don't know, like, you have a way that you tell these stories that it just, you get kind of immersed in it. And so I know for myself personally, when I was going through my master's program, I had a lot of difficulty trying to find my place with writing, because the way that I naturally wrote and the way that I like to tell a story did not always fit the research and academic style, which is a little bit more rigid and structured. And so I struggled with that a lot, to the point to where I struggled to find my voice on paper again. Like, I had to redefine myself in the academic sense. And then after finishing, trying to redefine myself in the more artistic sense. So I wanted to ask, like, while you were going through your college experience and writing and doing the different research and things like that, did you ever find yourself having any of those struggles, or did it maybe look differently for you? Because I've talked to other people, and they say they had that kind of struggle, too. But I wanted to know, like, what your experience was with that. And then, two, what did it look like for you after you finished college? Did you find that it had influenced your writing style or anything like that?
That's a fantastic question. I really hope that other people, because there's so many of us that have gone through that experience. You know, it's sort of sad, and I mean, I don't know how to put it, but it's like, I feel like there's a group of people like us. I'm going to put you in that just from what you said, but you can take yourself out if it don't apply. But like,
okay.
I feel like me, like, you know, going into academia because maybe we love Black culture and we really want to preserve Black culture and write about Black culture and all of this kind of stuff, and then find ourselves in positions where we can't write about Black culture in the way that we want to write about Black culture.
Yes.
And find ourselves having to translate Black culture to people that don't really care about it anyway. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So that's what got me more than anything. Because there'd be one thing if I was translating Black culture to another group of people that understood it in that way. Well, okay, then we're having a conversation. But you're telling me I'm going to have to change up my whole game to explain something to you, and you don't really care anyway, and it's not that deep for you. And so, I think that eats at the soul, you know. And I know that I was so lucky in that I've been so, like I said, I just believe in grace. I always had Black advice. And I always had Black advisors that were Black advisors. You know what I'm saying?
I do. No, I get it.
You know what I'm saying? So. So I always had Black advisors. So, like, I would just, so people could be straight up for me. And so I would turn in something and they would be incredible. This is beautiful. This is wonderful. Can you just make it sound a little bit more complicated just so it can pass by this other person? I know this is perfectly fine. I know this perfectly makes sense. It does not need anything else or anything like that. But I know that this white person gonna say, oh, why didn't he throw in this theory or something? Even though I can clearly see that you're using the theory, just throw in something, just quote somebody, just put a footnote, just do something. And
right.
You know, and
right.
So I have people that made that fooled me to the game and maybe understand that it was a game and didn't make me feel like there was anything wrong with me. They made me feel like, oh, no, what you're doing is right. What you're doing is cool. This is exactly what needs to be done. But, oh, boy, over here, there's been 10 years since 1956. Who's going to have to sign off on your thesis? He's going to need to throw in a couple things. And she would sometimes even give me the article, just put in this article, put in that. And it would be that simple. So I felt the great thing about that is I felt that my soul was preserved. And I feel like so many black graduate students go into it and their souls get eaten away because they think that there's something wrong with them and that there's not something wrong with the system. And by the time they realize that it's the system that's wrong and not them, they have scars, they have trauma, they have
oh my gosh, yes.
Takes a lot of what that takes a lot to get back from. I am so fortunate that I never had that. And then, you know, at one point it was literally like I'm tired of y'all. You know what I mean? Like, I started writing. I mean, it was really that simple. It was like, if I had done my master's thesis, I had done all my PhD coursework, passed all the little exams, whatever, whatever, whatever. And, I was just like, you know, there are people out here, cause part of it was because I was writing about pop culture, and I'm writing about it in academia, you know, I'm showing up at these conferences. It might be three people in the room, half listening. You know, maybe that was their little last thing they needed to check off on the conference. That and meanwhile, I'm reading things like Vibe magazine and reading like other things where people are really putting intellectual seriousness into the same things that I'm thinking about, and it's spreading widely among, you know, intellectual black people, and they getting paid. I'm like, wait a minute, something's wrong here. Something's wrong here with my audience. Something's wrong here with the economics. You know what I mean? And I just it became like an obsession. Anybody that I could write for, I would write for. You know, and then so that fortunately there was a local publication that really liked. I just said, hey, can I write something for you? I think it was something like on Black Gay Pride or something like that. And he said, yeah, but the music of Black Gay Pride, he said, yeah, I'll run it if I like it. If I don't, I don't. I was like, cool, cool, cool. So then he ran it, and then next week he wanted me to have a weekly column. Cool. That was the first thing I ever. And then, you know, I was the type of person that I just really didn't have any shame about it because since I was already in academia, it wasn't really my identity wasn't based upon it. So I would just be using the good old I was in American Studies. I'd be good using the good old American Studies Department little copier code. Beep, 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 beep. And, you know, making copies of all my clips and just mailing them out to any and every publication that I knew of and everything like that. And I just found like I was getting responses. And I was writing for the Village Voice. And I was writing for all of these kind of things. And doing it now, having been in the journalism industry, I think that's crazy because that's not really the way this is supposed to be done. But I didn't know any better, so that's just what I would even be using the department fax machine. If I found out the fax machine I'd just be faxing stuff like, hey, I'm a writer, I like to write, here's some stuff I do. I'd just cram, like maybe put 25 pages in the little fax. As soon as the administrative assistant left, I mean, I don't know where people might be still getting my faxes. You know what I mean? But it got my job, and I just started getting jobs. And then, in the midst of this, I got recruited to be a correspondent at Entertainment Weekly in New York, and this was still in the great times of where corporations still felt like it was their due to offer certain programs for minority people. So they moved me up from D.C. to New York and everything. Next thing I knew, I was working at a New York magazine. I did not know anything. I thought I was going to be fired. I would come home from work crying. Like, I don't know what a lead is. I don't know. Because I had been writing reviews, but they were always very kind of like streams of consciousness and this and that. And then I get there and they're like, oh, can you write this news story because such and such got cast in Star Wars? And I'm thinking to myself, first of all, I don't really care. But second of all, I don't even know how to write like a headline and all. So all of that stuff I had to look. I mean, it was humorous. Like, it was the point of like, I would be at work. This was like the first week. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to do this. And on the way home on the train, I stopped at the Barnes & Noble in Union Square and literally had to buy a Journalism 101 book. Yeah, so I could write the story for the next day, because I just did not know how to put together a basic news story, because that's what really wasn't where I was coming from. But as with everything else, I learned how to do it, I did it, and then one thing led to another.
Nice. Wow. Like, listen to that, I was like, oh my gosh, he gets me. Like, yes, yes, because when I was going through it, I would write something like, your writing is good, but could you put more of this? And you know, Ann Mastin is really who you want to cite here, and here's all her articles. But I'm like, well, she did the whole foundation for all of the research. So of course, like, did I not cite her enough? Like, are there not other relevant things I could talk about? And even
right.
Like with the thesis stuff, I got to the point where I was like, I'm not doing the thesis anymore. I'm going to do this creative component. And I thought that would be a better track. But then I started doing that, come up with this whole thing, and like, the advisors didn't get it. And I was just like, oh my gosh, like, I can't win with you all.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what it is that you want. Like, I tried it this way, I tried it that way. And so when I finally finished, I just felt like I'm never doing this again, because nobody seems, they don't care, you're just doing this to get out, and then what? And so that's why I asked that question, because I didn't realize until after I finished just how many other grads were kind of feeling that way. You know, you start looking back over things and like, wow, I was really like going through it, but I didn't feel like there was anybody who really understood me. So you had mentioned you gave like a lot of credit to the advisors that you had and things like that. Did you pick your advisors, or were they appointed to you?
No, it was just kind of one of those things of like, I was so passive about it. It was just kind of like, I would just be doing, you would like to be my advisor? Oh, sure. I didn't even know I needed an advisor. You know, I was that.
Yeah, I got you. Okay.
You know what I mean? And so it's just,
yeah.
Fell into the right. It just all fell into the right loop, and she gave me enough space that, because she had been through it. You know what I mean? Because she wasn't that much
right.
older, so she was the first. So she had been through it. So she was kind of like, again, she protected my soul, and I think that's, if you can do anything to a black up and coming academic, I think that's the thing. You protect that person's soul. Understand that. That is what's at risk, because that person came in there, in the system, to try to make a difference and to try to, you know, do something meaningful, most of the time about their people, and then they just slowly just get their soul and their creativity just ripped apart. So I feel like I did not know that my soul needed protecting, but I think that she
mm-hmm.
has the wisdom to protect my soul. And just even little things like, I remember my MA thesis defense. Like, I think it was no big deal. And I said, you know, so we show up, child,
uh-huh.
I'm wearing a t-shirt and some jeans, short, child. I'm wearing some t-shirt and jeans and some boot and some like boots or something. And she's like, I'm looking for everybody else's, you know, tweeted up.
Right, dressed up. Right.
So like afterwards, I was like, was there a dress code? Like, did I not get a little memo? And she's like, well, that's how people dress at the thing. And I was like, well, why don't you tell me? Because she said, I didn't want to change who you were to go into this space and make you feel like you had to do that, because I felt like your work stood enough. And if they had said something about how you dress, then I was going to fight. So, you know what I mean?
Nice. Wow.
Because a lot of times, too, we can say little subtle things to people trying to help them, and that can be as crushing on the soul, too. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
She could have easily looked at me and said, oh, child, you wearing that? Oh.
Right.
Or maybe, and just, oh, no, that's okay. Oh, that's okay. And would have made me feel uncomfortable walking the space. She didn't say anything. So I was sitting up there, my legs crossed, you know, a bare leg and leaning back. Well, I justified this. I said, and I wasn't thinking a thing of it. So, again, I feel like in so many ways I was really protected, and I just feel like it's so important for me to share my stories, because I just really want people to know that it is possible to get through this thing with your soul intact, with it is possible for you to go through the academic thing, be beat down and everything like that, but you can still rise and you can still find that, you can still find a way to say the thing that you wanted to say in the beginning and be able to articulate that and be the person that you wanted to be in the beginning. It is possible to get that back, because I think that is so, for so many of us, and we're talking a lot about academia, but just for so many of us, that is stolen from us in that process.
Right. Thank you for sharing that. Like, sorry, I didn't realize I was about to get all into that like that, but it's not often that, like, I run into somebody who, like, has been through that, but writes the way that you write about what you write about, and who has went through that process in that way. But to kind of jump over to the Aretha article, because that was the last thing that I read on the website that you had written. And again, just to like kind of harp on how well you tell stories, there was so much I learned about Aretha in that short article. Like, everything that I knew about Aretha growing up was everything about the church Aretha, the gospel Aretha. Everything outside of that never really came across my mind. And so the title of the article, for anyone who wants to go look it up, and it's on rmbeing.com, Divine Diva, The Gaze Who Shaped Aretha Franklin's Gospel Soul. Short article, so y'all could read it in like a couple minutes. But at the end of it, you had wrote here, in the wake of Aretha's passing, it is central that we praise the way she gave voice to the gospel impulse, the bringing together of people under a common purpose. She bore witness to our tremendous struggles as individuals, romantic partners, family members, and citizens, and provided hope that if everything doesn't immediately turn out right, at least it can get better. And I was like, that's huge, because when you read the fullness of the article and see the different people who influenced Aretha's life and who those people were, because as I read that, I had to go look up some of these people, and I was like, wow, Aretha makes so much more sense to me, and she's so much bigger than I even realized. Can you just kind of elaborate on like what Aretha's life meant to you, and if there's like anything specifically that you would like people to really remember about her outside of the obvious stuff that we all know, like her amazing voice, her gospel singing, and things like that?
Well, you know, I think that just goes back to just what I think in general when I write about any artist or anything like that. First and foremost, even though we revere these people, they are just people. Do you know what I mean? They are people that get up every day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they don't feel like getting up. Sometimes they don't feel like doing, you know, even though some of us, we all have some kind of gifts, Sometimes we're tired of them gifts. We don't feel like using them gifts. Sometimes somebody right. asks us to do the, we don't do it. It's like, I just try to really be into the humanity of people and just really make people understand people as human beings, that in these cases they are doing these extraordinary things because they are blessed with these extraordinary talents, and that adds an additional burden onto them on top of just how hard it is to get through life just in general. Do you know what I mean?
Right,
I
right.
to relate that. And Aretha went through some things. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Aretha went through some things. I mean, she, you know, lost her mother early, and then, you know, it was never, and she always liked to gloss over in her life, but, you know, that couldn't have been easy when her parents separated. Her mother left.
Right.
She wasn't away. She wasn't with her mother. She's pregnant when she was, like, 13. People try to gloss over that. It can't
right.
be easy when you're pregnant when you're 13. You
know? Right, right.
And you're in the church, and you sing in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, this was somebody that obviously had a lot of trauma. I'm not saying that in a, I'm not saying that in the kind of sense of, like, a judgmental sense, just in the kind of clinical sense of, like,
mm-hmm.
if a person goes through a certain number of things, you can tell, you know what I'm saying? Like, if a person
right,
comes
right.
back from Afghanistan after a number of tours, that person is going to have some issues. It's not a indictment of that person. That's just what we know about mental health. You know what I mean?
Right,
and
right.
And so I just feel like, you know, just really trying to understand Aretha as a woman, and as a woman that really, through all of this, was just kind of looking for love, yet it, and she was looking for love in a very intimate way, and I think she wanted to live her life in a very, very personal way. But she had this extraordinary gift that could move millions at a time when millions needed to be moved. You know, Al Sharpton has said that there would not have been a civil rights movement without Aretha Franklin. You know what I mean? So we're talking about
right.
ordinary people. It's almost like superheroes, you know what I mean? Like with the superheroes,
right.
it's like ordinary people that have to then, that find themselves with extraordinary talents that they have to then use, and that always takes a toll, you know? And
right.
those are the types of stories that I think I try to tell.
Right. Okay, and then my last one, about Miss Mary J. Blige. I know you're a big fan of hers, and I know you you had mentioned on your podcast that you you were talking about her at the award show and everything. I just want to get real quick just your takes on, like, Mary J.'s style at the award show and, like, her speech and just anything you would like to share, just because I really like your perspective on things, so just interested in what you have to say about that.
Mary is just one of those people. Like, you know how they say, what a time to be alive. Like, I am just so
yeah.
happy that I have been able to watch Mary's full career, because she's just one of those people that, as much as she tried to fight her greatness at the beginning of her career and tried to put it off and tried to get in her own way and everything like that, you could always see it. You could always see how great she was. You could always
mm-hmm.
see how she could connect to people. You could feel it. And so to watch the trajectory of that, I mean, Mary would get mad and fight interviewers. You know what I mean? If they asked the wrong questions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, interviewers out of, I mean, Mary was a mess. But to go from going that to being a person that can finally accept their greatness and stand in their greatness and do a tribute to their own self, that
mm-hmm.
is just a beautiful story to see. That is just beautiful. That's magnificent. That's not only black excellence, but that's a new kind of black excellence that we need to be striving for, because that's black excellence
yes.
and that's also black well-being. Because there are a lot of people that are black excellent, but they did not have black well-being. Whitney Houston was black excellence. Whitney Houston did not have black well-being. So it is just...
Like,
It just warms my soul to see somebody that can mature into their excellence and also be, I'm good with myself. That's an incredible, it's an evolution of us as a culture, you know, because we
mm-hmm.
really have had such a time where, you know, a lot of the people that put themselves out there as our voices ended up getting destroyed by it. But
right.
Look at Mary doing her own 19-minute tribute and standing up there like, yes, there is. You will see all this hair, but that's because this is a special moment, so deal with
yes.
it.
Yes, like, I loved when she said that.
Some days, you need a little bit longer, you need some more inches. So I love seeing that, and I just want to see more and more and more and more of that, where we just really see people that are able to grow, mature, be authentic, and shine, and just become greater than we've ever seen people be able to do. I mean, even if you think about like people like Prince, Michael Jackson, I mean, so many people, we have not seen that many of our great stars mature into there. You know, Mary will be 50 soon. You
mm-hmm.
know, we haven't seen people mature into those ages, and just to see what they're going to do, how they're going
right.
to reach back to people. We don't have that legacy. I mean, it's a shame so far into our history as black people, but we really don't have that legacy. So it just warms my heart. Like people like Jay-Z, like my heart, just
mm-hmm.
somebody of his stature that has been in the game for so long and can actually have the wisdom and everything to actually give back and to help people and to really give people, you know, as black people, sometimes we just need examples of like that people are just still living and thriving. You know,
yeah.
I mean, we're sometimes faced with so much death, faced with so much early death, and all this kind of stuff that sometimes it is just it just warms my heart and inspires me just to see somebody like Jay-Z at a certain age living and thriving with his family and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
We still need people to show us the possibilities of black life, and that's what something like the Mary's tribute meant to me, and that's why that was so important to me.
Thank you so much for that. Like, we could probably ask you questions all day. Thank you for sharing, like,
thank
all
you.
Of that. This has been great. Like, air hugs your way right now across
thank
the state
you.
For all of that.
Right. We got to take a real quick break, and I want you to stay on because I want to play this game. It's called the What's Wrong With You game, and we're going to go to break real quick. And when we get back, we're going to play the What's Wrong With You game. With Mr. Craig Seymour.
Yes.
Okay.
And Mr. Seymour, the game is rigged. I just want you to know that, okay?
Ignore everything that I just said. Not
factual at all.
We'll be back.
Your intention. What do you want from me? How much will it be?
No more than you're willing to.
should come to me.
Wait a minute.
I still don't think they've got it. Let's tell them one more time. Check it out. Everybody needs to know that.
Yes,
Luther Vandross and Janet Jackson, the best things in life are free. And we are back. This is the Buzz Studio, W Buzz, your global radio network. And back with the Soul Savage Show, Q Lynn Whitney, and an amazing interview with Mr. Craig Seymour, author Luther, the life and longing of Luther Vandross. Back to you, Q Lynn.
Yes, absolutely amazing. I'm being left speechless. Oh, man.
Boy, that's a first.
Yeah. Oh, it's a positive way. What? Listen, it wasn't.
It's
you
a first.
Appreciate my talking, because if you appreciate my talking, we wouldn't have you. Because then you talk about Pinot Grigio for 2 hours.
Oh, see, she's going there now. I don't believe it.
I'm just saying. You know what I mean? You got to appreciate the talking. You know, we take it awkward. On live, you know, this is live radio. We can't be awkward, so I got to fill in the space. It just so happened that I got so much to talk about. And,
yeah.
You know, I got to fill in the space.
Well, then you're speechless, and you just, it just so, don't seem to fit in the same, you know, sentence, you know. Okay. Whitney, what do you have to say?
You said what? No, repeat what you just said.
No.
Because I want to hear everything. Say it again.
You said speechless. You know, speechless and Q-Lynn doesn't go together. That's what I'm just trying to say.
Those two words don't go together. Nope. It's been many a time. I've kept quiet on this.
Okay, you're fine.
Listen, don't try to shade me, man.
No.
I caught every bit of it. Talk about speechless.
Hey, Q-Lynn.
Don't do that.
Okay. Listen. I'm just saying, you know, oil and water, you know, salt and pepper, you know.
Keep this beef going. I was trying to have a good day today, and not.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, you put the Pinot Grigio down. Put it down.
Great interview, Mr. Seymour. Thank you, sir.
Right. Well, I was trying to figure out where he went. We're going to do the 6 minutes of rage. If you're ready, Mr. Pinot Grigio, with your 6 minutes of rage.
I really don't. Did you scare our guest?
I don't know. He might be having a technical difficulties a little bit.
Oh, okay.
But we go figure it out. But just gonna keep it going. I'm gonna see where he went, and then we go move on and do 6 minutes of rage real quick.
Okay, all right. I think we could try to find this here. What do we have? Okay, Dougie Fresh. Let me see what we have. Okay, and you didn't say hey, welcome back, Will, or anything, but Whitney did.
Will, welcome back to the show. You've been gone for 2 weeks. You were missed because I've been wanting to do the raid. We kept the raid on hold, but we're going to do it right now.
Okay.
It's the raid,
y'all. Excellent. All right, folks. We are back.
Excuse me, Dougie Fresh.
Yes.
All right, we're back with the 6 minutes of rage. Guys, been gone too long, but we are back in the house. Hey, the G20 Summit. Hey, your friend, our favorite mushroom, is overseas right now. Oh, my God, amidst rape charges. Did you hear about that? Brand new rape charges. Oh, and it's been corroborated, but we'll get back to that in a minute. Boys trying to threaten Iran with war. I don't think that's a great idea either. Oh, my goodness. We have a crisis at the border, which he created, and now he's blaming the Democrats. Can you believe this? But, guys, on a serious note, though, when you hear about it and you witness it, and it happens in this country every day where kids are being, at the border, this kid and her dad drowned. You know, but we have tragedies all in the United States right now, and especially on the border. Nobody should be sleeping on the grounds, you know, under Mylar tents, out in the elements and things of that nature. But, oh, my goodness. Congress just passed something. Oh boy, but you know how they toss and turn and things don't happen, because look at the first responders out of New York City 18 years later, and still they're finally, I think, with the due pressure, they are finally turning over and they're going to do something concrete. What about Steve Harvey? There's a lot of news, a lot of rumors going on. Q-Lan, Whitney, I don't know what you guys know about this, and you probably already talked about it. But a couple of the shows are being canceled, and there are rumors about his wife's ex is writing a book, and there's a lot of rumors flying around. Tariffs, are they good or bad? Are you guys, how you guys loving those tariffs? How about that tax cut that you got that Trump gave you, which probably gave you about $37 in your paycheck, but when gasoline went up $60, guess what? Who's the loser anyway? And Nancy Pelosi say, oh boy, she doesn't want him impeached. She wants him in prison. And I just got a message that happens. Just don't drop the soap, okay? The Treasury Department is finally looking into why it's taking so long about the Harriet Tubman $20 bill. Guys, we already know. And guess what? We had with that Paul Ryan and now these Mitch McConnell. Oh, my goodness, boy. Guess put a hat on it, boy. Look like a turkey. Serve him up for Thanksgiving. Fantasia, she says she's cooked and clean and drives her own car, and understand that she is very frugal with her money. By the way, I just saw her in the airport this past weekend coming in from the East Coast. But anyway, a woman indicted after being shot. Whoa, back up. This woman is indicted after being shot, losing her child. Okay, what happens is, I think she instigated a fight, and the woman who shot her said, and the police said it was in self-defense. Amazing. Over 800,000 people are eligible to get their records cleansed for 6 months on, you know, like past weed charges, because, you know, in Illinois and a lot of other places around the country, you can be caught with a dime bag and you spend 10 years in prison. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. But however, the governor signed something right now, these people might be able to get those records expunged. And Charles Barkley is in the news. We're talking about reparations, and he says, guess what? I can't believe it. Charles, stick to sports, okay? I never liked you anyway. He said instead of reparations that the government should perhaps apologize. What? Well, he has more money than he needs anyway. And so guess what? For everybody else, hey, get up. Apology would be all right. And Mitch McConnell, getting back to Gooseneck here, he said something about, is there an issue with reparations? He says, well, I think why should people living now have to pay for something that sins for 150 years? But guess what? You're still reaping the benefits. All right. I said, oh, we fought a civil war. We passed civil rights legislation and we elected a black president. Okay, Mitch McConnell, I'd like to see your ballot. Did you vote for Obama? Okay. Oh, my goodness. Hey, guys, gals. It doesn't get any better than this. And I like to say, this is the Soul Savvy Show, and that's my 6 minutes of rage. Back to you, Q-Lib.
Call Mitch McConnell gooseneck. You take me out every time you say that. Mr. Craig, I was gonna ask you. I know you tie into all that, and that's a part of your history in terms of political and social issues. I wanted to know is this amazing to me how you unintentionally added those things. That how that just comes apart in your writing, just like naturally. You know what I mean? All the stuff that you were taught from your parents and how that was conveyed with whatever you're doing musically. I just want to know with politics and this climate we have now, what is it that you think that's missing to where we won't see a 2020 Trump presidency in terms of, like, are we more aware? Do you think social media is aware more now than when the 2016 election? Do you think we're more aware now, or do you think we're doing the same stuff that got him elected?
Well, I think everybody is terrified. everybody is. So I'm not criticizing people's social media behavior, because we're all out here.
Right.
Just scared to death. At the same time, we are scared, we also are trying to live the values that we truly feel that this country needs to live up to. Do you know what I mean? So it's like,
yes.
So we're scared, but at the same time, reparations are real. You know what I mean? So we're scared, but at the same time, we all need health care. So what I'm trying to, I can only speak for me, what I'm trying to do is just listen at this point. You know, I mean, I feel like we are so far away from even like primaries and stuff like that. I'm just really interested in listening to what people have to say and just see how the dialogue happen. And I'm not trying to cancel people off the bat every single, because somebody wants to cancel a candidate every single day. And I'm just really trying to just hear what people have to say and see how that can create a dialogue and how we can put forth things, you know, that are things that are going to benefit us as a people. And I think that the dialogue about, I mean, for, you know, in the Democrats, black people are hot on there right now. You know what I mean? Everybody seems to want to cater. So I'm enjoying being catered to. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just listening. Hey, what you got to say? Oh, okay, what you got to say? So I'm not really canceling people at this point. I'm just listening. And I guess the thing that scares me most is for us to go back to an old paradigm of kind of having everything be in the center and everything like that. I don't think that works. I don't think that that's what anybody wants. I mean, I really think that we do need something that is going to come from the left, something that's really going to address some of these concerns that have not been addressed. Some of these concerns haven't even been talked about since Reconstruction. You know what I mean? So I'm interested in these dialogues, and let's have them. I'm just interested in hearing things, but I'm trying to separate that from that kind of knee-jerk Twitter reaction of, like, every time somebody says something, not necessarily with the Biden thing, because I did think what he said was wild, but, you know, which is every time somebody says something to jump on that, I really am just trying to listen to the ideas and just let things work out, knowing that there is no perfect candidate in the first place, and there's no more imperfect candidate than the person we have in the White House right now.
Right. Yeah, that's a fair perspective, because that's how I'm coming at it, because it's like so many of them, that are talking, because it's just specifically Elizabeth Warren. Like, I think, because she's like the first one that I've seen from the Democratic candidates that have, like, she has a plan for everything, like, this, that, she knows her schedule for the week, grocery list, whatever you need, she got that for you. And so,
you need a man, okay.
It's all that, right. You got a plan for that, you need your a pre-workout grocery list, you got that. I got it for you, you have a fridge full of weeks full of prep food, but, yes. From what he said, we did this political segment called 6 Minutes of Rage, and we talk about the reason why he calls rage, because this whole presidency is like, we have like a raging lunatic, a raging hot Cheeto puff in office right now, so it's like, it's something with this guy, so we call it 6 Minutes of Rage. But do you think we're desensitized from it, or do you think that people are like fed up with it, and you think, or is it too early to, because I'm not really following the polls, because they, you know what I mean, they tricked us last time, but, you know, I know the states, do you think they're going to do a better job of catering to those electoral college states that Hillary Clinton lost that were, like, vital to her winning the presidency? You think that they're going to try to, whoever it is that's the main, you know what I mean, that's going to, I guess the main ones that's going to, the closer we get to the election, do you think they're going to focus more on that, or do you think they're going about it the wrong way?
I hear you. Like, when, you know, no, I don't, what is not going to happen on my black watch is for people to pretend that these white people in these certain electoral college states voted for Trump because of economic whatever. They voted for Trump because they racist. Okay, they
exactly.
voted for Trump because it activated racial animosity that they had. So whether Hillary has showed up in her goodest pantsuit, her best. It could have been pressed. It could have been the best. I mean, you know, hair could have been laid and whatever. I don't think there's no pantsuit cure for racism. Do you know what I'm saying? So I'm not sure. I
no
think that's kind of an artificial
cure for racism.
You know, and I mean, and the numbers don't lie. She did win the popular vote, so it's like I'm also not going to pretend that
right.
People, and so I just, you know, I understand that because of the Electoral College mess, you know, that we do have to play certain kinds of games, but I'm not willing to sacrifice my needs as a black man, as a black person, to feel like, no, we need to win some, you know, porn. I mean, no. I'm important, too. My people are important, too. My people that live in the city is important, too. My people that live down south are important, too. You know, I'm sorry you live in the rest, but whatever. You know, we all in this together, and you're going to have to learn to get along with us and our needs if you want to, you know, I just can't with the narrative of the poor old, you know, the poor white person that needs the help because of the opioids and all that kind of. I lived through the 70s when, you know, when my parents, friends, some of the brightest people that they ever knew succumbed to heroin and stuff like that. So I just can't get with that narrative like that. So like I said, I'm just sitting back, I'm listening, but when I get tight is when I feel like it feels like there's a narrative developing that means that the only way that we can win is to get back these people that only voted based upon racism in the first place, because you cannot campaign somebody out of racism. You know, that's just me.
Right. I just want to add, everything you said, I agree with 100%. I just want to add a little clip note that I love the way you said whatever. Your D.C. accent kind of came out when you said that. I appreciate that.
See, if people talk about my accent, they don't know what I'm... See, the thing about it is, because people are always like, why are you talking like that? I grew up, my grandmother is a milliner, and she's one of those people, she grew up in, she's country is country. She grew up in North Carolina. But when she came up to D.C., because this was around the time when you could get you a good government job in D.C., like around the times of World War II. Because that was actually some stability for black people, and the federal government actually had more protection for black people than other places. So she got in there, she was an elevator operator, and she happened to be an elevator operator at one of the places on this, I'll try to make this short, but one of the stops on the elevator was a hat-making store. So, you know, every now and then she'd go in the hat-making store, and she'd talk, and the man of the hat-making store thought she had talent and developed her. And so she ended up learning, and she then became making hats for people like Dorothy Heights, you know, of the National Council of Negro Women, and making hats for all of these really illustrious black women leaders. And now some of her crowns are in the National African American Museum, the Smithsonian, downtown.
Wow.
So all that to say, she also owned her own hat shop, and that was my job after school from when I was, like, in elementary school. You know how people send their kids down south for the summer? I just got sent to my grandmother's store.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent most of my formative years talking to older church ladies. So almost every way I talk, like, all my expressions, all my, even though, you know, like, I'll still tell my little brother, oh, run, go get me a Coke from the icebox. Like, you mean the refrigerator?
Oh, man.
That's why I talk the way that I do. And, you know, there was a time that I tried not to, and then I was like, you know what? I mean, this is me. It's just going to be me. And
listen,
if somebody doesn't like it, that's their problem.
Listen, I relate 100%. I'm from the Midwest. We're from Oklahoma. We say bitches. I still say that. Talk about,
I say ice.
I don't even know what that was. Book satchel. What is that? A book satchel.
Oh,
a backpack. A backpack,
yeah.
You mean? I don't know about a book satchel. I know I got a backpack. But yeah, you guys, I have such a love and admiration for DMV. I love y'all accent. Our producer's from Virginia. He be hard on the R's though. He be saying Maryland.
Maryland.
I say Maryland.
That's the area.
I love that. I love all that.
Yeah, everything's like Maryland. Yeah, everything is.
These new kids now, they be hard on the dirt. Like, they say, do dirt. I was like, whoa, hold on. I don't think they got an R at the end of it. A do. Like they pronounce it Mountain Dew or something. I was like, I don't think that's pronounced like that, sir. But I'm going to rock with you because I like it.
It's like, you know, the older I get, the more I'm just like, you know, this is us. This is like language. This crew.
I
we
love
created,
it.
We created this pronunciation. I'm not changing. You know what I mean?
I love it. I love every bit of it.
Live fully in us, you know?
Listen, we got to play a game with you real quick. It's called
okay,
the What's
okay.
Wrong With You, What's Wrong With You game. It's a completely judgmental game that I've made up.
Mm-hmm.
I make up the rules as I go.
See,
how
it's
I
rigged.
Feel like it. It's not rigged when I say that. I'm trying to make the person that's playing the game win. That's not rigging when you want the person to win.
Duh.
So, I'm just going to explain.
Sound like rigging to me?
I'm going to ignore everything that producer Will just said. Okay, it's false news, fake news. Okay, the premise of the game is basically either or. You just choose one artist or the other. It's not based upon, it's based upon, like, how many songs are there you have in a, who do you listen to more in your playlist? This artist or
okay.
that artist? And so the first one is Marvin Gaye or Teddy Pendergrass?
Teddy Pendergrass.
There you go, you're talking right. The next one is The Whispers or the OJs?
OJ.
Talking right. The next one is Prince or Rick James?
Prince.
Talking right. See, it's little tricks in here because those are all bonuses. So either one, if you were to pick one of those, you got it right. You know.
I told you.
But this part of the game is where that it's not rigged. We at the part of the show now where you have to get all these right, or you get a what's wrong with you. And sometimes I'm lenient. It just depends. And so this one is
I've heard
Michael
that
Jackson's
before. So.
This is Michael Jackson specific, Off the Wall or Thriller?
Off the Wall.
You talking right! You ain't get, you got that one 100% right. Okay, the next one is Patti LaBelle or Aretha Franklin?
Now what was the criteria again? How we judging people? I mean,
who do you listen to more of on your playlist? Patti LaBelle or Miss Aretha Franklin, The Departed?
Aretha Franklin.
Okay.
And I would say this, if you had said LaBelle, if you had said LaBelle and not Patti LaBelle, we might have had a different conversation because I do listen to a lot of LaBelle, but in turn, we're just talking
that
about
counts. That counts. That counts as Patti's catalog.
You
know, no, we count all that in there.
Say that at the first. We don't say that.
No, we add all that in there.
Okay,
that
so
counts.
If that counts in there, then Patti LaBelle, I will say LaBelle.
Okay, you talked it right. Okay,
LaBelle,
you don't get on what's wrong
LaBelle
with you.
LaBelle featuring Patti LaBelle. Okay.
No, all that counts. I'm counting all that is Patti LaBelle's discography. I don't care.
Okay, okay.
That
yeah,
counts.
Yeah,
a win is a
yeah,
win to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
What kind of game
right,
is this?
Listen, Will, don't judge, okay? Because I'm trying to make, it's not rigged when the person playing the game is winning, okay? Just leave it alone. He's winning, okay? He's not, he ain't getting what's wrong with you on that. If he would have said Aretha Franklin, if he didn't add the LaBelle part in there, then I had to ask, just for generosity purposes, I mean, I'm just curious. Name me three of your top Aretha songs that you got in your playlist.
Angel. Let me see. The Dark End of the Street.
Woo!
And First Snow in Kokomo.
Oh man, you done went. Oh, he done went to the cut. Because if he was, I thought he goes. Listen. The only ones I was gonna say, I thought you were gonna say until you come back to me, but that's, you hit all the cuts right there, so you talking right anyway. Even if you
okay.
said, if you said Aretha, you talking right. You, them songs right there, woo! Okay, we gonna move, the next one is Brian McKnight or Babyface?
Well, I am not a big fan of either, so I don't really even know what to stay
what?
With that.
You got every Babyface song in your playlist. What you talking about? After Seven, Karen White. What?
But you ain't
TLC?
Talking about producer. You ain't talking about producer. We talking about.
I'm talking.
Writers.
That's what I count as playlist. When I say
okay.
I'm talking about everything.
Look, you be changing. We'll be changing every question. But okay,
I told
yeah.
you it was real.
I said who do you have in your playlist?
It's just for All Night Long by SWV on the Waiting for Exhale soundtrack.
Yes.
I would say BBC.
Yes. The whole Waiting for Exhale soundtrack.
Yes, but I just love me some Coco, and I just All Night Long is the song I play most from that whole Waiting for Exhale soundtrack.
Nice. Okay, I'm gonna throw a bonus in there.
Yeah.
I know, I feel like I already know who you gonna pick.
I'm sure you do.
Will, Kayete. Okay, I'm trying to conduct it. Faith Evans or Mary J. Blige, vocally.
Now you keep putting in little things. I mean,
I told you I make up the rules as I go, okay? I told you this. I make them up as I go. That's what happens.
Yep.
I just make them up.
Weird. Told you it was real.
I love Faith Evans with my heart and soul. Faith Evans speaks to my soul. I love Faith Evans so much. But, I mean, just in terms of the body of work and just in terms of kind of the raw emotion that he put in my soul, I'm going to have to go for MJB. But Faith Evans, like, is just, I can't, Faith Evans is one of the best that has ever done it. And
okay, so I'm accepting the Faith Evans that you picked Faith Evans and you said catalog, and that's not what he said.
Whitney.
And so I'm going to Faith
Whitney.
Evans. And so I'm concluding. Since he's aced this whole thing, and he's picked all the ones that I said, there is nothing wrong with Mr. Craig Seymour. There's nothing wrong with him.
Oh, my God.
You won the game. You won the game.
Yeah.
The conjunction wasn't needed, because you answered the question when I said it. I know off GP you got to pick Mary J. Blige, but I know you picked Faith Evans. That's why you won the game.
Because
I know deep down, you know you're talking right.
Yeah.
You're talking right.
I'm not mad at that. You will never, a negative word about Faith will never come from my lips, so, you know.
Oh my goodness. I don't want us to stop going. This is like one of the greatest interviews I've ever done. I've done so many.
That's
times. It's like, this is
Thank
like
you.
Top five right now. This is crazy.
Thank
you want to stay on a little bit longer? We was going to finish off and talk about the BET Award. Do you want to stay on a little bit longer?
I don't mind.
Okay, well we're going to go to break real quick and we're going to wrap up and do savvy news. When we come back.
Okay. All right. I'll be here. Unless I get caught off.
We'll be back, y'all.
Summer. In the summer.
Oh, Childish Gambino, Summertime Magic, and welcome back to the Soul Saturday Show. All right, Q-Lan Whitney and special guest, Mr. Craig Seymour. Back to you, Q.
Yes, we had to start the celebrate Black Music Month. We celebrated the whole time on Soul Saturday Radio Black Music Month. Amazing artists. We had a little music things. I was like, it's summertime. I was like, summertime is just, you know, season is upon us. I'm like, why not play Childish Gambino, Summertime Madness? That's my first time ever hearing that song all the way through. It was one of Whitney's picks. And so I was like, why not play that song? It's a good vibe. I like it. I like it. It's real easy going.
It is. Yeah.
Pretty good. Craig, we have segments on, new segments we separated. We call Ragged News and Savvy News, you know, self-explanatory, you know, but I ain't got time for the negativity, these raggedy news stories of people. I didn't feel like looking them up. So I just wanted to get to the savvy and talk about the 2019 BET Awards that aired live on Sunday this past, on June 23rd, hosted by, DC's own, comedian actress, Regina Hall. I just love her spirit. It's just her humor and where she pulls from is so genius. I'm just a big fan of her. Like, if she did stand up, I would go purchase a ticket because she's hilarious to me. It's just, it's not so obvious. It's like witty. It's like that clever. I love clever comedy to where it's like, you know what I mean? It's not so obvious. And it's like the way she did that whole homegrown, the way she flipped that Beyonce homecoming and made that whole thing like that. It was so naturally her because she tied it in with DC, you know, where she's from and the culture behind it. And I loved how that was my takeaway from it. I feel like she was the perfect host because once they announced she was the host, I was like, oh, this is going to be perfect. I was like, I was waiting to see what she came up with. And I actually listened to your podcast. I listened to your podcast earlier today. And when you were giving your synopsis of the show, I was really intrigued with your point of view of how the show went. So I just wanted to know before anybody else goes, I was wanting to know, what do you think in terms of what they did? I didn't hear the last part, but did you talk anything about the Aretha? Were you disappointed in that, of them not doing Aretha Franklin tribute?
I mean, you know, tributes at this point have gotten so... to the point that it doesn't even seem like it's really tributing the artist. You know what I mean? Because it becomes more like people are keeping a scorecard on who hit the notes. Well, what songs did they do? Well, this person can't sing. Well, this person couldn't do it like them.
It's almost like you're not even really
thinking about the person that they're supposed to be giving a tribute to because people are too busy on Twitter keeping scorecards on every little note the person can hit and all that kind of stuff. So to me, it really takes the spirit out of it. So I almost think that that's played out at this point. And I think that's why Mary might have just ended that for a while. Like, cause I just think it's played out and it can never, nobody can ever do it like them. And then we already had the Aretha funeral, which, you know, the home going, which I thought had so many great performances in it that I just thought that it probably, was best to leave alone.
Well, I get that makes 100% sense because I never looked at it from that point of view before. And I look at it from, I just want it to continue on. Like, I don't want us to forget about those legendary singers and so. Like, I think it's just a part. I feel like it's too many musical critics online. Cause you know when I realized that was when Aretha's homegrown service was on, was televised on so many different networks and then online, independent owned networks that were streaming it live. It was just it's like people critiquing singers I'm like, this is a funeral. Like, these are her personal friends. Like, Melvin Williams, Vanessa Bell Armstrong, these people were hand-selected from her. And so they personally knew her. Fantasia, all these people personally knew this woman. And you really think somebody's given A+, you know what I mean? Because I feel like people forget the heart of an artist that, you know, this was their friend. This is a funeral. it just so happens to be, you know, the family was kind enough to televise it for everybody to see it because she was so beloved as an artist. But it's like these people have hearts. Like Ronald Isley couldn't even get through, you know, his Eye on the Sparrow because he was so, like, deep in the mourning. It's like, why are you critiquing this? Like, you, like, this is, like, America's Got Talent or something. It's like, no, it was just bothering me that people did that. And it's like, have y'all never been to a funeral before? It was just so weird. But it's just, they carried that on to, like, every award show. And I feel like those are the downsides of social media, is that you can never really enjoy it because people always have to, like with Mary J. Blige's tribute performance, I mean, her accepting the Lifetime Achievement Award and doing her 19-minute performance, it's like everybody's critiquing what she, I'm like, I'm just enjoying the moment. I'm in nostalgia mode. And so people are critiquing, oh, this note, oh, there's a lip sync track, oh, this is happening. I'm like, be in the moment. And I feel like so many people are so worried about the comic part of the trending part of Twitter to where they can, oh, let me throw the funny joke out here and see how it trends without, like, being in the moment. But I feel like for the most part, people were honoring Mary J. Because I'm into social media. I like live tweeting while the show's going on because it's like a kind of like family thing. It feels like every, when you're on the internet with people, it feels like you're like at home just talking crazy. But it's like a balance between like going too far and like, okay, stop acting like you're a judge on American Idol and just watch it and just be in the moment. So, but yeah, I love it.
Having, you can, because the thing about social media at this point is you can't trust the earnestness of the person. If somebody earnestly feels like a performance was bad, then whatever, they have the right to say that. But too often people are just trying to look for the joke, look for the flaw, just so that they can get that one little meme, that one little retweeted GIF. And that's the thing that I think has spoiled that sort of universal watching kind of experience. Because everybody, they're not being authentic. They're not really offended by that. No, they're not really, they are just trying to say it just for the point of trying to be funny. And that's like somebody, if you're at the movie theater, and, you know, occasionally somebody in the movie theater can make a nice joke when you're watching the film and you might laugh, but then there's that other person that acts like they're auditioning for Comic View circa 1999, and they just keep it going and keep it going, and it's never funny, and you just wish them they would shut up, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah, Whitney, who was your favorite before we go? Or did you have any highlights of who you like, of who performed?
Well, it's, you know, it was so much on Mary. I mean, I love Fantasia whenever she performs. That's not my favorite song by her. I like it all enough, you know. I think for some reason, and I think I said this in the podcast, it was good in that it was very professional, but for some reason it wasn't very interesting. Like, Regina Hall kept it interesting and everything, but it wasn't really, maybe it was the pairings of the people that came out. It just didn't seem like it had as much energy as the show sometimes does, but I thought that it also had some really great moments and really some inspiring moments, including like Tyler Perry's speech. So I think it was a really good show if it wasn't exactly the most exciting show, if that makes sense.
I get 100% what you said. Whitney, who did you like in the performance? I know you live for the Mary J. Blige part, but was there anybody else in the show that you liked? I like the Lil Nas X one.
Maybe I'm just too tired of that song. I mean, one thing the BET does sometimes, and this is just the nature of black music, changes by the day. You know, that somebody is hot, really, really hot. They become super hot, like, in a day, and so they almost need to be on the main stage. To me, Megan Thee Stallion needed to be on the main stage. If Megan Thee Stallion,
oh man, 100%, I agree with that.
That would have changed the entire situation for me. So everything else was kind of like, why ain't Megan here? Because Megan's the hot, literally the hottest.
Everybody's she'll be on there
talking
next
about
year.
Right now. Yes,
right.
Will.
Once her album go, you know, platinum, her LP, because she hasn't. I think because, you know, they got to be technical. I don't, you know, I feel like it's a, you know, the gender bias thing. Because if it was a male, she'd be already on there. But I think once she's like popping with a whole LP, you know, debut album, she'll be on there. I 100% agree with that. And I like the little, you know what I like about it? Because I like that it's so age appropriate. And I, you know, because I'm not used to songs that trend like this that are like lyrically sound, that's not so, you know what I mean, perverted for kids. And so I just love how kids, I think it's just that response, kids have to it. And just everybody in general, I just love that. Even though it may not, I'm not listening to it on a daily, but I know it enough to where I've heard it long enough to where, you know, I know the words to it, but yeah. I just love the reaction people have to it, especially when I'm out, you know, doing live gigs at shows and stuff, performing, and they love that song. As soon as you start playing the little guitar lick from it, they start the Old Town Road. I'm gonna take my horse on the Old Town Road. Like, they just go in on it. And I think kids just love, I just love the energy from it. But yeah, I'm just here for the, I'm their auntie now. So I'm just here for the tribute. Like, that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm staying. But,
the other thing that I miss, and there was an organic opportunity for it, but I miss those times when, remember how like somebody would sample a song, and then on the BET Awards, they would have the artist and then the person that the artist sampled sing it together. So like when, Monica did You're Everything to Me, and then Denise Williams came out and sang Silly with her, or when, and I'm telling you, I'm not going, when the Dreamgirls movie came out and Jennifer Hudson came out and then Jennifer Holliday came out, I kind of missed those type of intergenerational moments that I think the BET Awards used to do really well. And I thought that component was kind of missing too, you know.
Yes, I want that to come back as well. I love that. I think the little switch up whenever they got rid of, what's that guy's name? Stephen Hill. I think that's what changed it, yeah. Because he used to do that a lot or whatever, but maybe that guy, Jesse Collins, that, you know, produces the show now, will probably implement that, but I don't know. But I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show. We got to wrap up.
Thank you so much for coming on.
You dropped a plethora of gems, and it's just something I just know just from how you write, how you convey what you're trying to tell an audience through your work, through your writing, that it's intentional, like you said, with the artistic intentions that you have with writing. It's like beautifully conveyed, and I just know it took so much for you to do that. So I can't wait to read. I'm just going to be like a fanatic of Craig Seymour and just be binge listening to interviews and your work. I'm still studying it, and I'm just
I'm gonna have to get you that Rick James interview pretty soon, because nobody's ever heard my interview with Rick James. So I'm thinking I'm
gonna
have
to send that. I'm a Rick James fanatic. I'm a fanatic.
That
Rick
interview
James.
Was crazy.
Oh so my goodness! I'm gonna hit you. We're gonna talk about that off air. We're going to talk about that off air. I want to hear it. But thank you so much for coming on. You're just beautifully great. We have to have you come back, because I just have 27 more questions for you. I had to limit it. But thank you so much. This has been Soul Savage Radio. We don't have a Savvy Heathen Talk. Craig, we have a segment called Savvy Heathen Talk. Do you have something quick you want to say to take us out?
What do you want me to say?
Like, just anything that's on your mind. If you got anything positive you want to tell the listening audience before we go.
Just follow your dreams, y'all. No matter whoever needs to hear this right now, no matter what obstacle you may be going through, just follow your dreams. You may be down, get back up. It's worth it. People want to hear from you. Just follow that dream.
Y'all make sure y'all follow this man on all social media outlets, Craig's Top Life. You go to craigspoplife.com to keep up with all of his beautifully written articles and books, and buys books online on any digital outlet that purchases books. We out, y'all. Soul Savage Radio. We'll be back next week, every Thursday, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We out, y'all. Old school nigga, 84 El Camino, LBC, no, we love Big B though, I.E.Y. Nigga, even Bernardino. When we party on the West Friday,
strictly for the weather, women, and the weed. Sticky green, no.
the hood. Ain't no love lost.
Y'all know I'm from the west. I'm the king to be exact. You better holler at me when you need that grinding sack. I got it all. One call, no stall. On the ball. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Listen to me. Holler at you, dog. Words of the clever forever multiply. Birds of a feather preparing on the fly. Perfection, selection. This is a B-I-G-E-P-G-C connection.
I'ma spell my name one more time. Check it. It's the N-O-T-O-R-I-O-U-S. You just lay down slow. Sipping on booze in the house of blues. Wait,
when we party on the
And you've been listening live to the Soul Savage Show on Studio W The Buzz, your global radio network. Hey, coming up, we have a special rebroadcast. Mr. Melody and Mellow Moves, the Mellow Moves Show, coming up right now here on Studio W The Buzz. And for your listening daily pleasure, go to StudioWBuzz.com. StudioWBuzz.com. Okay?